I'm Captain Frank Mummer with the Maryland School of Sailing and Seamanship. We pride ourselves on being a serious school for serious sailors. In this session, Captain Tom Tersey and I talk about how teamwork affects seamanship and vice versa. We'll start with a tragic incident in the Atlantic and discuss things that we think could have helped. Let's get started.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the inaugural Maryland School of Sailing and Seamanship. We're going to call it a podcast until we figure out what else it is. I'm Captain Frank Mummert, for those of you who don't know me, and I am one of the instructors at Maryland School. And tonight we have Captain Tom Tersey, the senior executive lead instructor and master or knower of all things on the show with us tonight. And he and I are going to discuss a topic for a little bit, and then we're going to go on and we're going to open up the floor to y'all, and you can ask a question about the topic that we've been talking about, or you can ask a question about anything you want. What we want you to do is we want you to put the question in the chat, and then I'll take a look at it, and then I'll call on you to ask you to come up, and then we'll answer your question the best we can. And then based on that, you can either ask us another question or we'll go on to somebody else. We do appreciate you being here tonight because this is a learning experience for us. We have used Zoom repeatedly in the past, but this is our first opportunity to do this particular format. And we're kind of hoping we can do this on a weekly or maybe a bi-weekly basis. We're going to see what happens. Okay. Tonight, the first thing we want to talk about is the subject for tonight is basically how teamwork on a boat affects seamanship and how a lack of teamwork can seriously degrade the ability of the boat to function. We happen to have a part of what came out of this is that Tom and I were discussing a video that we saw, that we each saw in the last week or so, about a boat that had some serious problems crossing from Bermuda to Nova Scotia about 2 years ago. And because that's an area that we're kind of familiar with, when we looked at this particular story, there were some questions that came up out of it that we really said, why would you not do this? So just to give you a little bit of idea about this, I want to first talk about the boat itself. If you're familiar with Cruising World magazine, this particular boat, this is a CNB 66, that's 66 feet, was the winner in the luxury class. It was the boat of the year in the luxury class in 2022. And the boat that we are going to be talking about was actually the boat that the Cruising World judges got to sail on. It was actually these people's boat, and the two people who the owners were actually on board the boat and went sailing with them. And one of the things about this, one of the judges said that the build quality was just impeccable. The layout of the CNB was terrific. They didn't try to cram things in, but had three really nice cabins with an ensuite heads and a nice desk office area plus the chart table. Aesthetically, it's a really pretty boat. The owner understood how to sail it well, and he had a system where he could handle it solo. He proved that you could operate a big, sophisticated boat alone. Okay? Now, I want you to keep that in mind when we go forward talking about the actual incident. The other thing about this, in another comment, it said it was a big boat, but it looked like it worked. And we sailed it today in very light air and she moved well. So I came away with a stronger impression after being aboard with the owners under sail. Now, so it handled well in light winds. But again, it's a 66-foot boat. This particular 66-foot boat had hydraulic and electric controls for winches. It had a furling main into the boom, and it had a hydraulic furling head sail. Okay. Now, what actually happened back in June of 2022, the couple that owned the boat, German couple, had brought the boat out of the Caribbean and they'd gotten to Bermuda. They brought two experienced crew members on board in Bermuda, and they were going to travel to Nova Scotia. Just a couple of notes from a Blue Water Cruising article here. Conditions during the next 24 hours were milder, winds between 10 to 18 knots. Sailing downwind, even with full sails in these conditions, required escape to mo escape was the name of the boat, to motor for several hours. Carl, the male owner, continued to download weather from PredictWind via Iridium Go and communicated via email with his weather router in Germany. 2.5 days into the weather and in the weather path and passage were exactly what was predicted. Escape was safely ahead of schedule. So now we are traveling from point A to point B, and we're doing very, very well, and we're ahead of schedule. Now, the evening of the 11th of June, weather reporting indicated that by midnight or a bit after one, Escape would need to begin motoring for the final leg of her passage to Canso, Nova Scotia. Winds were predicted to drop to 12 knots, continuing to fall further overnight. After sunset, the second mate took the 2100 to 0100 watch. With winds 18 to 20 knots, Escape was comfortably making 9 knots under full sail. So we at this point, we have all sails up. The owner went below to rest up. Around 2200, winds began to pick up to 25 knots with gusts near 30. This has happened to me offshore. I know it's happened to Tom offshore. The prediction is for a general area, but there can be very, very different localized conditions. Escape was heading, it was heeling. More rudder was required to maintain steerage. The second mate, third mate, and the Anna Marie, the female owner, agreed that they should wake Carl to come and reef. It took all four of them to reef the boat. Carl looked at conditions and decided to put in one reef. They turned Escape into the wind and reefed smoothly, as they had done now at least five times. Carl went back to his cabin to rest, and Escape sailed on for another 30 minutes to an hour. So they had, working as a team, done five reefing evolutions during this trip. They're like 3 days into it. Nearing midnight, contrary to predictions and weather reports, they ran into a storm about 350 nautical miles due south of Nova Scotia in the Gulf Stream. Winds increased steadily to 30 to 35 knots sustained. Sea state worsened with waves around 20 feet. When they brought Carl back up again to put another reef in, a 40-knot gust began to round Escape up into the wind. The second mate put the wheel hard over all the way, trying to maintain a course. The Escape was heeled over, her rail near the water. She was barely holding course. Carl called out for a second reef. The engine was started. Everyone took their normal stations. Carl gave the go signal, and the second mate headed Escape into the wind. Waves were now nearing 27 feet, and they were crashing over the deck. The bow was riding high and then pitching down. Carl was at the controls, starting to furl in the Genoa while attempting before attending to the main. Anne Marie was behind the main sheet winch, which is central in the cockpit, just ahead of the twin wheels. As Escape came into the wind, the second mate noticed the boom was not centered per usual. During every other reef, the main sheet was properly tensioned, centering it as Escape turned into the wind. The boom began to swing with the waves. At this point, waves are coming from a lot of directions because of the changing wind and current conditions. Carl yelled instructions to Anne Marie in German. The crew, the two mates, were not German speakers. Carl left the Genoa control lines and ran to the main sheet winch to help. So he stopped doing what he was doing and became task-focused on helping the rest of the crew. Anne Marie stepped out of the way toward the port side winches as Escape was pitching while pointed into the wind. Her boom swung from starboard all the way to port. The main sheet struck Anna Marie across her back, knocking her to the cockpit sole on the outside edge of the cockpit seating. As the third mate crawled to help her, Carl, without hesitation, ran to Anna Marie. So now everybody's trying to focus. We've now lost control of the boat. We're trying to focus on this crew member. The second mate yelled to Carl that the boom was swinging back. Escape's boom swung back. The main sheet caught and threw Carl to the starboard side, shattering his left leg below the knee with compound fractures. Within 10 seconds, both of them were seriously injured. As the boom continued to swing, Escape's main sheet snapped and her boom was completely free. At some point, the preventer had snapped as well. Now, this preventer was a Dyneema cord. The third mate laid Anne Marie flat, pulling her out of harm's way into the cockpit seating area. And then the current third mate helped pull Carl further from the danger area, and they made more room to get Anne Marie closer and more protected. The third mate immediately started first aid, grabbing a tether off a life jacket, using it to tie a tourniquet above his knee, trying to staunch the bleeding. He went below to grab med kits and the EPIRB. He set off the EPIRB, and then he began to bandage Carl's lower leg. Again, what we have here is the boat at this point is almost out of control, and everybody's focused on getting medical aid to the injured people. The third mate started calling Mayday over the radio, VHF radio. He got no response, so he retrieved the sat phone. He handed it to Carl, who called for help while the third mate continued radioing over the VHF in the event any vessels not appearing on AAS might be in the area. When Carl made contact, he said they were speaking English, so he passed the satellite phone back to the third mate, who managed all communication via the companionway from this point forward. All the while, Escape was out of control. Her Genoa and mainsail were flapping wildly. The swinging boom started losing loft, first grazing the Bimini and then ultimately crushing and buckling the Bimini metal frame. When the boom swung to port and slammed into the shrouds, the second mate quickly turned Escape east to pin the mainsail and boom against the spreader and shrouds. So now they're running downwind with the wind holding the sail in position. But now the end of the boom is occasionally submerged in the waves, which will throw it back into the boat. Second mate was able to gain some stability running downwind, finding the autopilot could sometimes hold for a minute or two until waves rocked Escape and manual piloting was required to prevent an uncontrolled jibe. The second mate crawled to the starboard side winches, managing to furl the Genoa, which is now ripped in several places, returning immediately to Escape's helm, steering downwind for almost 3 hours, lying prone, looking up at the wind indicators atop the mast. The second mate periodically helped the third mate tend to Anne Marie and Carl. The heavy rains, winds, and sea continued. Escape was now almost 400 nautical miles offshore, running at 10 knots with the wind and the Gulf Stream pushing her further and further east. To take this story to the end, what eventually happened is the two mates were able to get a lasso onto the boom as it swung through the cockpit. They were able to tie it down. They finally got in contact with the Coast Guard, who was able to arrange for a helicopter to get out to them using some, the helicopter had to leapfrog using a Coast Guard cutter along the way. By the time the Coast Guard got the two injured people back to the land, they were both dead. The Coast Guard took the mates off the boat, and the boat was eventually towed into Nova Scotia. That's a long story. It really lays out the problem. So Tom, at this point, what would you say happened that where do you see the problems in this?
Well, there was a complete failure of seamanship. You need to respect Mother Nature when you're out in the ocean. There are very, very immense forces that can act, as illustrated here, breaking the main sheet and the preventer. Winds over 20 knots. And it all could be avoided very, very simply by having good personal rules about how you're going to sail and in what kind of conditions are you going to continue sailing or heave to. And I've been out there many, many times with winds up to 50, 60, 70 knots. And when it gets that bad, you heave to. You stop fighting it. You're not going to beat Mother Nature out there. It just isn't going to happen. So with building winds, building waves, quartering waves, making the boat have a corkscrew motion, it's hard to steer, very, very prone to a deadly jibe. So running off is really like the last thing you want to do in heavy weather conditions. You just don't want to be running off. Because with running off, you have those conditions of quartering wave, corkscrew motion, and therefore a deadly jibe is very, very likely. Good probability of it happening. It's going to lead to a break to hardware, as done here, and you're really sailing the boat into a black hole, of which there is no escape once conditions have gotten so bad. And I think you said that the waves got up to 27 feet. When you get over 12 to 15 feet with winds over 30, 40 knots, and those wind and those waves continue to build, and you're sailing off downwind into this black hole, the chances of you turning the boat safely to windward and heaving to at that point are very, very low right probability. When you are running downwind in conditions like that, the boat is on a hill on this great big wave, and I realize the boat was 66 feet long, but still a 27-foot wave probably has a downslope of well over 100 feet, maybe, I don't know, 200 feet. So this boat is going to accelerate down that downhill on the leading of the forward side of the wave, and then you have the potential for it to hit the trough, suddenly stop because it's trying to dive into the water and it's buoyed up and stop. And this is when the boat can broach, meaning turn to the side, and then be rolled by that wave action. Running off downwind, you have an exposed cockpit. You have the potential of boarding waves from astern. The crew in the cockpit and the companionway are exposed to waves and weather. You really can't turn back. It's almost impossible to make that full turn. As they found, they couldn't reduce sail. Adler Coles wrote a book in 1970 titled Heavy Weather Sailing, and he presented a lot of different case studies of people who lost their boats at sea. And the bulk of these case studies, they were sailing off. They were sailing into that black hole. And what you should be doing is early enough, be conservative, don't be in a hurry, heave to and get into a proper heave to condition and ride the waves instead of acting like a bulldog that you're going to drive yourself, drive this $2 million boat through those great big waves is crazy. You have to be like a cat and roll with the punches. You're not trying to fight it. You have to roll with it. You have some big ships, big steel ships, that in storm conditions, the waves will actually rip steel machinery off the decks, which has happened many, many times to ships in storm conditions, which illustrates the power of the waves. So the big issue is the waves. The wind we can deal with if we're oriented properly to the wind. So I feel that the big issue here was a complete failure of seamanship on the part of the skipper in terms of how he planned to handle those conditions. It sounds like he was in a hurry. He was under sail and under engine power, and you just have to take your time. As I say, like on a Bermuda trip a couple of years ago, we hove to actually 24 hours. You just have to take your time and be like a cat and roll with the punches. So, Frank, that's my perspective on things.
I agree with you completely. I was on that trip. We were hove to. We actually traveled 25 miles in 24 hours,
Yeah,
just
right.
because of the Gulf Stream. I think the other thing that came out of this to me is, and I didn't actually present this earlier, but these two additional crew members, the mates, came on board, and then they were supposed to come on board like 3 days before they got underway, and apparently a weather window opened and the captain decided that they were going to go ahead and shoot out, and they would train people along the way
In a hurry,
in a
in a
hurry.
hurry.
And that, I think, is the biggest issue here, is that it's very easy to train people to do things in a kind of an ad hoc way if everything's going well. But it's when those situations go to pieces on you, you need to have everybody knowing what you need them to do. And I think that was That was a serious problem here. The other thing to me is I think the captain got task oriented. And it's one of the things I'm always trying to impress upon students is that if you're in charge of the boat, you have to be in charge of the boat, not the person who is making sure that knot is tied correctly. You have to train your people and then trust your people.
Well, and as you well know, Frank, that what we do is we always have pre-departure training for a couple of days before we go offshore. We go through all the procedure, all the boat, and all of that sort of thing. So not just talking about it, but actually doing it on board.
Yep. Yeah, as a matter of fact, David Gifford and I were talking about that today. We were kind of looking at the procedures that we're going to be using for the Bermuda trip this year, and making sure that we've kind of gone through them in our own heads again.
So let's see what our audience thinks.
Yeah, let's get some statements out here. I've got a question from Howard Hillman. Language barrier definitely would have had an effect on the speed at which tasks could be completed. Is there a workaround? Howard, you want to turn your camera on, or we can just discuss that. Tom, have you? I've had non-English as a first language students on each of the Bermudas I've done. What have you found as any kind of workaround for that?
Well, the basic thing again is number one, pre-departure training, so that people already know what you do in certain situations and how you do it, and number two, don't let the situation on the boat at sea get so out of hand. Now, my understanding is that the owner of that boat could speak English, but in that emergency, he switched to his native language, German. Okay. And what I'm saying here is avoid the emergency situation by taking early preventive action, early appropriate action. And then you don't have the panic in which you're going to revert to native language. But beyond, you know, hand signals might have some benefit, but I don't really see it for the situation we're talking about.
No, I have a feeling that offshore at night, in the dark, in the rain, probably hand signals. And this is one of the reasons I don't like hand signals, is it's very easy for people to misinterpret them. Although shouting in a different language probably is another way of getting people to misinterpret your ideas.
Yeah.
Let's see. I have a comment from Robin saying sail reduction guide for your boat is a good idea. I assume, Robin, you're talking about having something that says at this wind speed, we're going to do this. At this wind speed, we're going to do that.
Right. Yeah. Two comments before that. Fully agree, of course, with Tom with reefing early. But I remember on my first trip with Tom, or this 45-foot Alameda, and you reefed. I still remember distinctly to this day, we're going across the Gulf Stream, and you reefed at 15 knots. And I thought, wow, only 15 knots? Why are we reefing now? But I understand as my sailing career evolved to reef early, and it was so prudent of you because it was getting dark, we're bouncing in the Gulf Stream, and the boat, we did not lose boat speed. The boat was balanced, and it sailed well. So one, I think, reef early.
The other thing in this situation where he had a roller furling boom, and he's trying to reef a roller furling boom downwind, and that sail is going to be blown forward in the roll. In other words, as it enters the roll, the sail above the roll is going to be blown forward, and it's going to start to bunch up. And it's going to jam. And I believe that's what happened in this case, that it jammed. They couldn't get it to roll because of the strong wind from astern, blowing it forward.
Yeah, it actually discusses later in the article that they could not get it to come down more than about a foot at a time.
Yeah.
Because the boom had to be centered in a certain way.
Right.
Yeah.
So again, being off wind and trying to furl it is impossible. Go ahead, Frank.
No, I was just looking to see if I had any more comments here. I've got a comment from Jochen that says it's prudent to reduce sail at sundown. I think that's...
I usually reduce the mainsail.
Yeah. If we have put it up, we will reduce it down to at least the first reef anyway. And Tom, your policy is always, if you see lightning, we're going to put a reef in.
Absolutely.
Because if there's lightning, there's wind coming.
Yeah. There's actually a lot of additional things I do if I see lightning 10 miles away. I know it's going to, for some reason, if that lightning 10 miles away never goes the other way, it always comes towards me. And there's a lot of preps that you have to do as far as buttoning the boat up and reducing sail well in advance of that squall getting to you. So again, my big message in all of this is early preparation.
And not making it into a race. Stop right. and wait.
Take your time.
Weather will work around you. Yep. Let's see. Oh, a new message. Hold on. Boom against the rigging endangers the rig. Absolutely. Boom against the rigging is going to endanger the rig. But in this case, two options were to have that boom flopping back and forth or to pin it up against the rig. I definitely... It definitely needed to be under control as much as possible. One of the things that fascinates me is it said that the preventer was ripped out at some point. And what interests me about that is that they had been sailing downwind. They decided to come up into the wind. They brought the boat into the wind and realized they didn't have control of the boom because the main sheet wasn't tight. And that's how they got into confused seas and the boom started moving back and forth. I'm a little confused about where the preventer was at that point, because in the discussion, and this may simply be that it's just not in the information we have, in the discussion, it doesn't really say what they were using, other than the fact that the preventer was Dyneema, what they were doing, how they were rigging it or anything like that. But the fact that it got ripped out as part of the boom sliding back and forth, I think is an interesting thing to me. Again, if that preventer had been holding better, it would have definitely kept the boom more under control. Okay, I have a question from Ernest. In those high winds, how much would you reef in order to be hove to? Tom, what do you think?
Well, on the Navigator, our Island Packet 40, I have basically two reef points, which are a second and third reef point. In other words, the boat was originally designed with a reef point 1 and 2. I got rid of the number 1 reef and put it in number 3. So I have a second and third reef, basically, which is... So if I have forecast winds, I can heave to that boat with that third reef in, okay? And on that boat, I do not need a head sail to heave to. I can heave to with just the mainsail on the third reef. And what's interesting, I find that the boat and heaving to, the boat is basically between, let's say, 40 and 60 degrees of apparent wind. Okay, so what I don't want to happen is for the wind ever to get in back of me in those kind of conditions, in really bad conditions. So if I'm hove to with at let's say 40 knots, and I'm hove to at maybe 40 to 60 degrees apparent wind. If the wind comes up and I don't change anything else, the boat will head up more. It'll head closer to the wind to maybe 35 to 60 apparent. Okay. So in any event, that's my experience. Now, if storm conditions get really bad, then what we plan on Navigator at sea is to put up the storm trisail, which is a storm mainsail, which is probably smaller than my third reef mainsail. It is smaller. But also, if it continues to build like up to 60, 70 knots, we would put out the sea anchor and heave to with the sea anchor and the main trisail.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. I you know, I've been there with you. One of the things about this boat that fascinated me was it's got a roller reefed main, which made me really question why they didn't drag more of the main down. You know, they talk about going to a first reef and a second reef. You know, it's like saying that the main head sail has a first reef and a second reef. It doesn't. It's where you need it.
I think they were in a hurry.
I agree. I got another question. It says, could you guys talk about fore reaching versus heaving to and which to use when? What do you think?
Well, fore reaching is simply when I'm hove to, I am fore reaching. In other words, the boat is going to oscillate between 60 degrees apparent wind and then head up to 40 degrees apparent wind and then slow down and then fall off and speed up. So basically, hove to, as I described it, is fore reaching because you are making headway ahead as well as to leeward.
Yeah, I think.
So, excuse me, Frank. So does this gentleman have a different understanding of fore reaching versus hove to?
Bill, you want to pop in here and give us some information there? Tell us what you're looking for.
Guys, can you hear me?
Yeah. Did you have a different understanding of fore reaching versus hove to?
Well, honestly, I'm not positive. I've heard that fore reaching is actually just sort of, you know, heavily reduced sail plan and kind of slogging off the wind, maybe 60 degrees and whatever tack, is going to benefit you the best, you know, with the waves, with the waves. So, you know, I guess my understanding was that fore reaching was a normal sail plan, not, in other words, not a back jib, not heaving to, and actually, someone at the helm, you know, and actually sailing slowly with a heavily reduced sail plan off the wind. That was my kind of general understanding of fore reaching, but I'm not sure. I've heard various things about fore reaching. I'm still not clear that I'm clear on it.
Yeah, Bill, my understanding, I think it's just a question of terminology. When I'm hove to, as I described, I am fore reaching. You're putting the jib on the leeward side of the boat so that you're actually sailing with the two sails as opposed to having the jib back. I think it may be a different just terminologies.
I think the other issue here is that heaving to, the basic concept of heaving to, which is keeping the boat at a certain angle and keeping the boat speed down, is a kind of a generic term, and there's different ways to do it.
Depending
on the boat. And so what a lot of people get taught is heaving to is you back the head sail, luff the mainsail and lash the rudder over and boom, you're done. And that works in a lot of times, particularly on a lot of boats in lower wind conditions in more protected waters. And I think what we're talking about is the thing you got to keep in mind is that what you're trying to do is you're trying to balance the force on the bow of the boat and the force on the stern of the boat. The force on the stern of the boat is controlled more by the rudder, and the force on the bow of the boat is controlled more by the sails. And once you reach the point that you've pulled out that head sail and it's no longer, you don't have the head sail up, you don't have the staysail up, now you're having to force the bow into the wind with the mainsail. So it's not something that most people get taught, but it is definitely more of an offshore technique.
But it's a thing that you have to experiment with different boats. In other words, it's not going to be all the same. Like I say, on this IP40, we don't need a back head sail in order to heave to.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I got a comment from Jochen. It's kind of, I'm going to say that this is a comment to you, Tom. It says, how about the Halimeda example of the forestay breaking at night? And I think I know this story. I think this may be the chain story.
That was a different boat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, Jochen, Halimeda, there was actually a design deficiency in the in the head stay rig on the IP-40. Basically, to make a long story short, on the head stay, they used a stem ball fitting, in which one end of this fitting had a half of a marble, basically, which sat down in a seat, and that that fitting was then pinned with a clevis pin to the headstay cable itself. And we actually on Halimeda broke the headstay offshore three times on three different occasions. And one of those occasions, I was not on the boat at the time, but it was halfway between Norfolk and St. Thomas. So it was about 700 miles from each direction, and it broke. So the headstay and the sail were basically hanging off of the halyard, the jib halyard. And fortunately for the rest of that trip, they didn't have any heavy conditions, and they motored the rest of the way to St. Thomas in that case. So after having a couple of these experiences, what I did was every year I replaced the stem ball. I figured, well, if it's going to break, I'm not going to redesign the rig, because it would go a couple of years and then break. And it was a matter of learning what its propensity was. So I just started replacing this $100 part every year, and problem went away.
Yeah, Tom, I remember it very well. I was Derek Morton's mate on one of the trips.
You were heading into Bermuda, right?
Yes. And I do remember our course of action, which was very successful. We used the halyard to stabilize the mast forward.
All right. Looks like we got time for one more question or comment, if somebody wants to throw something out there. From regarding the sea anchor and the storm sail, how do you practice with this as far as your team building prior to departure? Absolutely. Every class going out and coming back, we will rig the sea anchor at the dock so that everybody sees how it gets rigged. Storm sail, we'll run the storm sail up its own track. The storm sail has its own track rigged. We'll run it up. We'll secure the boom. And we want people to see that long before we have to get into a situation where we're going to need it. Tom, how many times have you actually deployed the sea anchor?
We deployed it about four times. And I say I deployed it once, but other captains had deployed it also. One of the things I want to say about actually putting into the water is once you put it into salt water, you have to bring it home and soak it in your bathtub to get all the salt out. Otherwise, the salt is going to destroy the material if you put it into storage. But let me mention one other thing just in response to the question. Yes, we practice. We don't actually put it in the water. We deploy it to the dock. But the key thing is getting it properly rigged so that you don't have lines crossed and you have lines leading fair as they're supposed to. Because once you put it in the water, and you found it, oops, I got it wrong, rigged wrong. It's wrapped around a stanchion, and it shouldn't be. You're never going to get it back. You're never going to get it straightened out. You're just going to rip the stanchion off. So the big thing is getting the stuff out of the locker, out of the bags, rigging it on deck so that everybody knows how to rig it, and everybody's participating in this. And then we do a mock deployment onto the dock. So that's our process there.
Yeah, it's important that, we're not teaching people how to steer the boat. We expect that people coming on board the boat know how to steer it, but we're definitely bringing out the gear that people don't use on a regular basis. And that's really important for these, for the 104s. For the 108s, we do some stuff on the 106. We don't rig those, but we do that. I got one last quick question. Any bar fight example? All right, Aldo. No, I am not going to get into a bar fight with Tom on anything. Not even a little bit. All right. And thank you all for being here.
Frank, yeah. I think this might be Jochen. I'm not sure. It says, I find it odd that with electric winches, the boom could not have been controlled quickly.
Well, you remember the main sheet broke, right?
Well, it did.
Not Jochen.
Oh, it wasn't Jochen. Okay, somebody else. Okay. Same initials.
Yeah, I agree. It should. Well, here's what happened in my mind. Because the boom had to be in exactly one position, when they tried to bring the boom into that position, something went wrong. And rather than fixing that problem, the captain left his spot and ran down into the cockpit to try and fix that problem. And I think it got kind of, as I said, the captain got task focused instead of doing the things he needed to do and control everybody else. He was running around trying to do things. And within a couple of minutes, two crew members were injured to the point where they eventually died.
Well, this is another thing as far as understanding the limitations of your equipment. Now, I realize that on 60 and 70 foot boats, many of them have roller furling booms, roll the mainsail into the boom. But you have to understand with that kind of a furling system that you have some limitations as to how much you can be sailing off the wind and what kind of wind strength and still furl that sail down. So this gets back to the concept of simpler is better at sea. And for some of you who already know that on our IP40, that our mainsail is a simple mainsail. We manually reef it with old-fashioned lines like they used to do before furling systems on main booms. And it has no battens, and it's as simple as a mainsail can be. And my concept is at sea, things that are a little bit more complicated go wrong. And there are times when they are tested severely. And in this case, this boat that was tested severely, they couldn't get it down. And they didn't realize the limitation of that furling mainsail in the boom until it was too late.
And I think that's the other part of this is that they had been on board the boat for a couple of years. They had sailed it across the ocean a couple of times or in long distances a couple of times by themselves. And they decided to bring on some additional crew. And they weren't focused on how to train the crew. They were focused on let's get going. All right. Thank you all again. And one of the things we want to do at this point is we want to ask you to send us topics that you would like to see us talk about. And the best way to do that is office@mdschool.com. If you send an email with a header line, Tuesday chat, and that way Rita will know what those are, and she'll kick those to Tom and I, and we'll be able to make decisions from that. We, like I said, we'd like to do this on a weekly or biweekly basis. That's one of the things we're going to be discussing internally. But we definitely want input from y'all as to what we should be talking about, because otherwise it's just Tom and me, and we go off on all kinds of tangents that aren't really going to be helpful. Okay? And with that, we're going to wrap up tonight. Thank you all for being here, and hopefully today gave you some value.
Thank you all. Bye.
Good night, all.
Frank Mummert here again. We hope this discussion helped you by giving you some things to think about in your sailing experiences. If you have thoughts on this subject, please don't hesitate to send them to us at office@mdschool.com. That's office@mdschool.com with Tuesday chats in the header. Thanks for listening and happy sailing.